industry attempting to find panels that I can moderate simply because it's my vocation. And therefore, I'll leave that as a sufficient introduction of myself. We have a very distinguished panel, in fact, and I've had the opportunity in advance to see some of the material and presentations, and I can assure you that the substance and the content is unusually apt and forceful and filled with insight in a way that I have not often seen at some of the sessions at International AIDS conferences. The whole question of food security and livelihoods and HIV is, of course, growing in import year after year as people understand both the decline in agricultural productivity for individual households, the ravaging of income that occurs when one or more of the people are stricken with the virus, and the objective international difficulties which obviously exist around food security. You've got food prices rising and oil prices rising and drought taking hold of large parts of the continent of Africa in particular, and you have climate change looming as a possible sabotaging ingredient of life on the southern part of the continent. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that received the Nobel Prize with Al Gore identified southern Africa as the place in the world that would feel the impact of climate change more forcefully than any other part, at least initially. And on top of everything else, we've had recently the breakdown in the Doha trade negotiations, not a surprise to anyone, but clearly with grave implications for agricultural security. So when we talk about food security, livelihoods, and HIV, we're talking about increasingly compelling issues which suffuse the debate around the pandemic. And as I said, you've got five really excellent panelists with fascinating contributions to make. We anticipated the lead contribution to be that of Stuart Gillespie, who is with IFPRI and Renewal, and whom I knew well from previous sessions that were held by WFP and FAO at previous AIDS conferences. Stuart's plane didn't get here on time. This is a conspiracy which is visited on many, I notice, in coming to Mexico City. We will take the perpetrators before the International Criminal Court, but for the moment, we are without Stuart. We are, however, with a wonderful colleague of Stuart, whose name is Sunita, is it Kadiala? And who is also directly associated with the Renewal Program, which is the regional program on food security and livelihoods. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute, better known as IFPRI, and at IFPRI she was with the Regional Network on AIDS, Livelihoods and Food Security, which is Renewal. And Stuart, when he sent me the email saying that Sunita would step in his absence, admitted somewhat forlornly that she would do a presentation vastly superior to his own. Sunita.
Thank you, Stephen Lewis, for the kind introduction. It's difficult to follow right after you with your eloquence, and even more difficult to fill Stuart's shoes, but I'll try my best. Ordinarily, I would organize the conference organizers for inviting me to present here, but in this case, I would just thank United Airlines for having me here. So the topic I'm going to present is, let me first introduce briefly what Renewal is. As Stephen said, it's the regional network on AIDS, livelihoods, and food security. And when I look around, there are many of you in the audience that have been some associated with Renewal since its inception in 2002. And for the past 5 years, I've been working with Renewal, and we are active in five countries. I think it's Zambia, South Africa, Malawi, Kenya, and Uganda. And many of the regional country national coordinators are among the audience if you wish to know what's happening more in these countries. Now, what I'm going to now talk about is the three coexisting and interacting crises of AIDS, malnutrition, livelihood, and food insecurity. I'm just going to give you a quick overview of the interactions, but also walk you through some of the latest evidence, especially since, say, last AIDS conference. And and leave you with some of the implications. What are some of the policy and program options that are in our arsenal? So many of you have seen this slide before, which is a Renewal's logo slide, pretty much, that HIV and AIDS and food insecurity and malnutrition are viciously interlocked in a vicious cycle. On one hand, food insecurity can increase susceptibility to HIV transmission through various routes. And on the other side of the downstream impacts, HIV and AIDS can exacerbate the already existing food insecurity and malnutrition situations in sub-Saharan Africa. I'm going to first talk about the upstream. What is the evidence? What do we know about the role of food insecurity, often seen through the lens of poverty and its relationship with HIV susceptibility? So the question is that does poverty or wealth drive HIV transmission? Renewal, along with UNAIDS in 2007, posed this question, and we examined the issues on what exactly we know given the current evidence thus far. And that has resulted in an AIDS supplement in 2007. And I'm just going to give you quickly two slides on what the synthesis says. When you look at the macro level, there seems to be a direct relationship between income inequality at the country level and HIV prevalence. Here in this slide, you can see HIV prevalence on the y-axis and Gini coefficient, which is a measure of inequality. And this scatter plot, a correlation matrix, shows is that as the inequality within countries increases, then there is a higher HIV prevalence in that country. But as most of you also know, that this is an association and we need to scratch under that surface. And when you look at large panel data sets that look ahead and track people, then what the evidence shows is that economic status is not a strong predictor of HIV status in Africa. Perhaps this is because the epidemic now in its mid-2000 to now is much more generalized than we expected it to across economic groups. But what the evidence continues to show is that, unequivocally, that the impacts of AIDS are most severe among the poor. So we should move away from seeking magic bullets and simple explanations and accept that this is a complex relationship, and the relationship between economic status and poverty is often mediated by many factors. Poverty and food insecurity, especially of women, of course continue to be a crucial part of the whole story. Then there are other mediating factors such as mobility, fragile livelihoods, access and ability to use information, and we know that people who are oppressed and people who are, you know, marginalized, and those include people with HIV, have compromised ability to access, and even if they're able to access information, ability to use that information. Then there are occupational related nodes of risk, such as, occupations which can increase the high-risk behaviors. So these various factors, this is not an exhaustive list, but clearly these are some of the important mediating factors that we found to be quite important. So, but the news is also unequivocal in terms of, from the evidence that we have reviewed on the relationship between education and HIV status and women's economic independence and HIV status. Both are protective against HIV. So we need to continue to invest in education and improving economic independence of women, empowerment of women, and continue to ramp up the AIDS-sensitive agriculture and livelihood development programs. Now, what do we know? Once there is HIV in the body, and once there is HIV in the household or the community, what happens to the nutrition status of a person, and what happens to the food and nutrition security? And this, I'm going to talk briefly about this. Malnutrition is associated with immune function decline, and degree of malnutrition, protein energy malnutrition, is clearly linked with mortality risk. The recent studies, especially from observational studies, show that malnutrition compromises efficacy and increases ARV toxicity, and it increases ARV side effects, compromises adherence. We also know from observational studies in Uganda and Malawi that people who initiate ARTs, antiretroviral therapies, when they're more malnourished, are more likely to die, 3 times more likely to die in the first 3 months, 3 to 6 times more likely to die in the first 3 months than people who are not malnourished. So clearly nutrition and the nutrition status is important to before someone starts ART and as people start ARTs as well. And there's a lot of there's substantial evidence to show that many micronutrients are associated are result many micronutrients slow the progression from HIV to AIDS, although the role of vitamin A and zinc is not consistent. What is the latest evidence on the impact of AIDS on food insecurity? The latest evidence basically confirms what was present at Toronto and many other publications by many esteemed colleagues and stakeholders in this arena. But what the evidence basically shows is that impacts are determined by the degree and type of vulnerability, and this is often revealed in responses, what we tend to call as coping or impacts or effects. Vulnerability is basically the change that a person or an institution ability to change plus the inability to change in response to a particular situation. But vulnerability is not something constant. The vulnerabilities that people face today are not the same as vulnerabilities that people face 2 years down the line. And I think the global food crisis that our next speaker is going to talk about is a good example of that, which is clearly going to interact with the existing vulnerabilities and play out probably in not very desirable ways. So the effects of so what are these vulnerabilities that that have been often studied and said? These vulnerabilities depend on household demographics, and here is a list of various various conditions and contexts in which the vulnerabilities get played out. So clearly, given the evidence of the role of food security and nutrition, there is a scope for various sectors to come together to scale up the response to AIDS. So here, the last three slides I'm going to present are in relation to the role of what can food and nutrition research and programming do along the continuum of prevention, care, and treatment, and along the continuum of HIV timeline. So if you look at prevention, which is, you know, classic, one of the core pillars of an AIDS response, studies from Botswana and Swaziland show that women who are food insecure are more likely to engage in high-risk behaviors. So clearly, strengthening women's food security should be a top priority. We need to explore alternatives to migration, or where that is not possible, at least make migration a safer venture. There is convincing evidence to show that maternal malnutrition increases mother-to-child transmission of HIV, and improving maternal nutrition is fundamental to preventing future infections of children. If you look at care and treatment, nutrition interventions have a pretty important role to play in terms of improving immune function before ART, before an individual is put on ARTs, and also to ensure optimal ART outcomes once they're on ARTs. And on the final aspect of the timeline, which is the mitigation, work by Michigan State University, for example, in various countries in sub-Saharan Africa, show that the real constraints to adequate food production and food security depend on multiple contexts, which relates to the vulnerabilities I was just alluding to. And this include cash, labor, land, and we really need to investigate in various contexts what these are and address those real constraints. work with actually the World Food Program and Renewal and many other colleagues have shown that children's human capital is under formation of children's human capital is under threat. Children who have experienced parental death or AIDS in their households are much more likely to die, are much more likely to falter in growth, and much more likely to have compromised education outcomes. So it is imperative that we all act and improve and continuing and scaling up investing in children's human capital formation for a better future of our children. As far as what Renewal is doing is that we know that clearly, although there is this neat timeline displayed there, that within a household, these things don't exist like in that framework of horizontal timelines. Many of this prevention, mitigation, care, and treatment along the timeline coexist within a household. Therefore, along with Renewal, we are concerned worldwide, WFP in Uganda, and the AIDS Support Organization, we are trying to investigate the role of food supplementation in adequately addressing the prevention, care and treatment, and mitigation aspects. So thank you very much with that, and I hope I adhere to the time limit.
Thank you. It's quite remarkable how committed you were to speaking within the timeline suggested, and that so rarely happens that I want to acknowledge it as being worthy of a Nobel Prize. I was particularly taken, if I may be so presumptuous, with the emphasis on nutrition and nutritious foods and malnutrition and their links, because increasingly this is becoming a centerpiece. I remember Paul Farmer saying publicly that at the Partners in Health project in rural Rwanda, he's now spending 28% of his budget on food in order to bring a nutrition component into the lives of those who are struggling with the pandemic. And the relationship of food is everywhere being more fully understood. Food prices, however, are intensely complex and Byzantine in their application, and I'm very glad, therefore, that we have Martin Bloom here to give us a sense of what the consequences and implications are. He is the Chief of Nutrition and HIV/AIDS in the Policy Department of the World Food Program. I'm a World Food Program groupie. I love the agency. It is one of those UN agencies that does remarkable work in the field. I once, back just a few years ago, did a tour of Southern Africa with James Morris when he was the executive director of the World Food Program. And I remember his response both to child-headed households and to women who are living with the virus and clearly impoverished and vulnerable, and his determination spontaneously and intuitively to begin to redirect the work of the World Food Program to vulnerable communities. And that indeed happened, and it has given WFP a central role in what has emerged, certainly on that continent. Martin holds positions at the John Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and at Tufts University, and he's worked for some 20 years in the field of development. Martin.
Okay, what I'd like to do in the next 10 to 15 minutes is a little bit, you know, a discussion on what the impact is of high food prices in the field of nutrition. I think Sunita already explained that food security has, of course, much more implication than only looking at nutrition, because it looks at livelihood, but I will not focus on that. I will only focus on nutrition. And it's, of course, always very difficult when you start to discuss this as someone who works for the World Food Program, because people will say, you always are biased because you would like to give food because that's your business. But a lot of the data which I will show you is actually coming from my previous job when I was working for Helen Keller International. So it's a little bit unbiased in the sense of World Food Program perspective. You know, I will start an email which sent out last Friday, I think. It's an email forward to one of my colleagues. And there's a lot of confusion in the field saying, you know, what does it mean, these high food prices? You know, what is the impact on HIV/AIDS? What's the impact on nutrition? And it's very understandable, of course, because, you know, there is this huge information over the past couple of months that it will have, of course, a lot of impact. But people don't know, how do we measure that? You know, who are more vulnerable? And these are very valid questions. And so one of the things we have tried to do within WFP is working with UNICEF and thinking, okay, what is the evidence of high food prices on the impact of nutrition? And there are not many studies, in fact. There are only 8 studies in the literature who have really looked carefully at this impact. So what I try to do with you is to look a little bit at my own experience, which are about 3 papers out of the 8 papers. The first experience we had was in actually in 1994, when I was working in Bangladesh, and we had set up a surveillance system. And we looked over that first period, and you can actually see it here until 1994. But in the beginning, we looked also at seasonal impact, and we saw there was a very interesting correlation between the rice prices and, in fact, the differences in malnutrition. But, of course, it was only a very short period. So in 2003, we did a paper, and we looked over a period of 10 years. And what you could see here is that there is a decline in the rates of malnutrition, and we used underweight as the primary indicator. And there was an incredible correlation between the expenditure on rice, which is the main commodity in Bangladesh. You could see that here. Oh, sorry. Well, the next slide shows you that, in fact, there was, during this whole period, when there was a decline in malnutrition, there was not an increase of rice intake. In fact, there was a decrease in the rice intake. What you see over time, when a country becomes more, in fact, you know, more rich, then in fact the intake of commodities actually is declining. So, what's happening actually among poor people? Well, you know, Amit Sen always says, okay, poverty is a matter of choices. You know, if you are poor, you have hardly any choice, and when you're rich, you have a lot of choices. And of course, if you translate that in what it means in food, so when you are very, very poor, you only ate staple. And in this case, in Bangladesh, it was rice. When you're very poor, you eat rice and vegetables. And the more you become affluent, then in fact you have, you include meat and eggs. And the more expensive products, of course, are animal products, which are very rich in micronutrients. So if we follow this and said, okay, this is coming from Peter Timmer, one of these books on food policy. And what's happening is that when a country becomes more rich, in fact, it increases their energy intake. But at the same time, of course, it also increases the intake of micronutrient-rich food. So Bangladesh was about at this level. So it moved from more energy deficient to less energy deficient. And so... if you look at this slide, it shows very clearly that the decline in malnutrition was very much determined by, in fact, the increase in the expenditure on more, you know, nutritious food, which we call the non-grain food component of the food expenditure, and which, of course, is determined by micronutrient and the right fatty acids and all these kind of, you know, very nutritious products for actually increasing the growth of children. So this experience helped us to understand that, in fact, what we need, of course, during a certain time period, that if we talk about food, we just can't talk about food in general. We have to be very specific. We have to talk about nutritious food. And in 1998, when the economic crisis broke out in Asia, we were by accident in, we were working in Indonesia at that time. And we said, oh, this will have impact, of course, on the nutritional status. And but Indonesia was not a country like Bangladesh, which was energy deficient. In fact, Indonesia was more at this particular level. So it went from about here to here. So we couldn't expect an impact on malnutrition, but what we could expect is an impact on, in fact, micronutrient-rich food, because they couldn't afford those food, and of course, then you could actually expect micronutrient deficiencies. So we looked at many different of these aspects, but because of the time shortage, I can only show you one indicator, which is vitamin A deficiency. We look particularly at maternal night blindness. And maternal night blindness is a symptom or a disease which happens quite often among pregnant mothers. But also it happens on women of reproductive age in general. And it's a disease which has been studied extensively in Bangladesh as well as in Nepal, but also in India. And women with maternal night blindness have about 3 to 4 times higher risk of dying than, in fact, women who have none of these symptoms. So we looked at that in Indonesia, and we knew that before, in fact, the crisis broke out, there was no prevalence of maternal night blindness at all. But what happened after the crisis, it immediately went to a level which was similar as what we have seen in Bangladesh at the same time. So then we did a logistic regression analysis, and this data shows you a little bit about one of the main indicators, which is, in fact, the weekly food expenditure on animal products. And you could see there's a dose-response relationship. We take, in fact, the lowest intake as one. And you could see it goes from the odds ratio, which explained to you a little bit about the importance of that indicator for the outcome, and which maternal night blindness goes from 0.68 to 0.66, 0.72 to 0.47. And it explains in a way that, in fact, the intake of these highly nutritious food was the main determinant of the increase of maternal night blindness. Oh, sorry. When we looked over time, what you could see here is that, so at the beginning, the level was suddenly at 2.5%, which is what I said before, a similar level of prevalence as what we saw in Bangladesh. Before the crisis, we couldn't see it at all. There was no prevalence of maternal night blindness. So you can imagine how a shock, which was not even the same shock which we are seeing now during the high food prices at this particular moment, had an increase in this disease. But what happened over the period of about 3 years' time, that symptom diminished, and now we can't see any more a prevalence of maternal night blindness. And it was correlated with, in fact, the increase of the food expenditure on animal products. So you could see what's happening now as a result of this is that the increased food prices, but now, in fact, they are stabilized. The high food prices will not go away for the next 5 years. That's the prediction of both the private sector as well as of the World Bank, and even some people say it will even be longer than 6 years. This is not what happens, in fact, in Indonesia, where you have a very short shock, only for a couple of months, in fact, where you had the food prices. Here you could already see that you had 3 years' time to recover from that shock. You can imagine what the impact will be on nutrition over the next 5 years. I think we underestimate the impact on nutrition, what will happen. It will be major for many, many people living in Africa, Latin America, but also in Asia. So if you do the translation to what it means for HIV/AIDS or tuberculosis, I think Sunita already explained quite well what the relationship is between malnutrition and HIV and AIDS, although there's still some discussion about whether an extra amount of micronutrients will be beneficial. It's quite clear that when you have a deficient population, you will have an increased incidence, for example, of tuberculosis, and an increased risk of mortality. But in fact, we have three phenomena in the world. Now, we have malnutrition, both in children as well as in adults. We have HIV and AIDS, of course, caused by the virus, and we have tuberculosis caused by bacteria. And so, in fact, there are three different etiologies, but of course they coincide with each other. So when you think about HIV/AIDS, the current advice, and I take a very conservative view on this, although I believe there's a much more role for nutrition in this, but the current WHO recommendation is an increased energy intake, and we need at least one RDA of my commutants. Well, at this particular moment, as a result of the increased food prices, you will see an enormous increase of micronutrient deficiencies. And nobody is covering, in fact, one RDA of micronutrients during treatment or prevention. So even when you're conservative, we are not doing that work. Increased energy will have definitely a big impact, and we're not doing that either. So I think the impact will be that we may hasten the disease progression, we may see maybe an increased mortality, and it's also possible that, in fact, our PMT disease programs are less effective. When we talk about tuberculosis, and I think this conference will discuss a lot about the interaction between tuberculosis and HIV and AIDS, and about joint programming, in the evidence for the impact of nutrition in tuberculosis is much stronger. We know that, in fact, that the incidence of tuberculosis is related with malnutrition. But definitely even there is more evidence for that micronutrient treatment will have an impact on, in fact, the treatment effectiveness of tuberculosis. So just a few seconds about, of course, it's much more complex. It's already what has been discussed before. And I only highlighted one small component of the high food prices on nutrition. But we know it has a major impact on other behavior issues as well as on livelihood vulnerabilities. So one issue is, for example, an increase in risk sexual behavior as a result of more poverty and lack of food availability. And we know this will also have additional effects. It's not as beautiful. But anyway, this slide shows you what we did a couple of months ago. WFP hired a consultant, and they went to two different places, to Swaziland and Malawi. And they just looked for a qualitative perspective at what, in fact, the impact was according to the people who were interviewed. And the main issue is, in fact, that it was much more dramatic than we had expected. And these, of course, are very qualitative data, very preliminary. We need more hard data to show this, although I think we have to act more than we should have collecting data. But it's quite clear that people are vulnerable who cannot act in a similar way as they could a year ago. And I think a lot of our treatment programs, as well as our HIV-AIDS programs, will be much less effective as a result of high food prices. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Martin. That was fascinating. And the emphasis on the graph of the graduation of the gradation, really, of poverty and its application, and the emphasis on micronutrient deficiency is most interesting, and that reference to the study of Botswana and Swaziland and risky sexual behavior. I had been reading the UNAIDS report, and I was so struck by the quote that I jotted it down and I found it, and I want to read it to the audience. It said, quote, "According to a recent study in Botswana and Swaziland, women who lack sufficient food are 70% less likely to perceive control in sexual relationships, 50% more likely to engage in intergenerational sex, 80% more likely to engage in survival sex, 70% more likely to have unprotected sex." That's an extraordinary degree of implication in the study around the absence of food. Our next speaker is going to take us into the practical application on the grounds in what are called hyperendemic areas. Hyperendemic areas are defined, I think, Farzai, as countries where you have a prevalence rate of 15% or higher in the 15 to 49-year-old category. So they would include, obviously, South Africa and Botswana and Namibia, Mozambique, Lesotho, Swaziland, Zambia. Those are the hyperendemic areas. And Farzai Mukanawashuru is an HIV and livelihood she says, officer, specialist, really, with FAO in emergency and related application. She holds a master's in development studies and is studying towards a doctorate in livelihood and antiretroviral treatment. Farzai provides backstopping for FAO, I like the term, in 7 countries in Southern Africa on HIV and rural livelihoods. Farzai, the microphone is yours.
Okay, thank you very much, Stephen. How do I get this up? Okay, thank you. Okay. Thank you. Okay, morning. As you have just heard, I am in the Southern Africa, where we have been trying quite a number of interventions as the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. But today, my presentation is going to look very much at what has been tried, some of the interventions. So this presentation will really go down and be more operational in terms of what really can be done to improve livelihoods and food security in these hyper-endemic countries. I would like to discuss more the strengths in terms of these interventions, to also look at the challenges and then the lessons learned, and also recommendations for programming, because I'm aware quite a number of you have been trying some of these interventions, and it may be interesting to know what community perceptions have been on some of these interventions. So, as you have been told, I will focus mostly on Southern Africa, which, as you know, is home to 60% of people living with HIV and AIDS, and most of the livelihoods are very dependent on agriculture, and as well, we've had protracted food insecurity since 2002, as well as nutrition insecurity. Okay, you might say most of these interventions, you are very aware of them, but I would like to go a bit more into detail in terms of some of the studies that have been undertaken, and some of the community perceptions. How do they perceive some of these interventions in the context of HIV and AIDS? The first one, of course, being food aid. This definitely is something that has been appreciated by communities. It's an intervention that we cannot really do away with. And I think the previous speakers have spoken about, you know, the food prices, etc. So at least with this first intervention, I won't go much into it. On community and household gardens, we have seen, and as a study that has been done recently in Zimbabwe has shown that communities have really perceived this as one of the most important interventions. Why? Because it has been providing quite a diverse number of foodstuffs that families can consume at household level, and also really has improved household nutrition security through this dietary diversification, as well as it has also improved the behavior patterns, eating patterns of families. But we have seen that this intervention really works if it is in conjunction with nutrition education, not just the provision of nutrition gardens, but with nutrition education. And this package normally comes along with things like food hygiene, how to preserve food, and issues of how to incorporate other kinds of foodstuffs in gardens, such as agroforestry. We also looked at small livestock, which seemed to be quite promising. And an example is really from Lesotho, where they've reported that small livestock for HIV-affected households has really been instrumental increasing of assets, household assets, as well as also providing things like animal protein. And then on food production, this diversified food production, we've seen also interventions that have worked, such as those that have promoted the orange-fleshed sweet potato. There's an example, a very good one from Mozambique, where communities have been growing this orange-fleshed potato, sweet potato. In Zimbabwe, they are starting to grow cassava, which has not been very, it has not been grown that much in Zimbabwe. But because these families would like to diversify the kinds of foods that they're eating, this seems to be coming up well. As well as also the traditional foods, we have seen with the advent of HIV and AIDS that communities are really going for the traditional foods that they had done away with before the advent of HIV and AIDS. Then the next one is quite interesting. I think one of the previous speakers spoke about the issue of labor, that labor is really a challenge for affected households. And communities have really gone out to go and organize themselves. In Zimbabwe, we call it Zundera Mambo, which is an initiative that has been taken up by the chiefs that they provide labor to actually grow food for affected households. The same can be said in Swaziland, where they've taken more or less the same model and built up on the traditional system of assisting each other in terms of social capital, and this seems quite promising. I know Michelle will dwell more on social protection, especially on the cash transfers, but in a recent study that has just been done by, in Swaziland, I'm trying to think. This study has looked at households that have received cash and have received food as well. And it has been shown that those households that receive cash and food actually even use the cash to actually buy more food. So despite them receiving food, they also go and buy food with the cash that they receive. So it looks like people are not really irresponsible with the cash that they receive. Then the next intervention is on life skills. As you know, FAO has been quite instrumental in what we've called the junior farmer field and life schools, which has been operational in a number of countries in Southern Africa, and which we actually say try to catch them young. Because when we look at nutrition habits, when we look at food production, it has been quite successful in bringing life skills for producing food to these young children that are still growing. The same can be said with school gardens as well, where these interventions of producing food have been introduced in the schools. And what has made this intervention quite successful is that it's not just the ministries of education that have been working on the school gardens, on the life skills, but they have now incorporated ministries of health as well as ministries of agriculture to provide these life skills. The next three interventions that I've put in blue are more the institutional responses, which we have seen to be working in Southern Africa. The first one being the nutrition counseling care and support for people living with HIV and AIDS, which brings in the whole scenario from production to actual consumption and brings in aspects of nutrition education. And this has been building up the capacity of mostly agriculture sector workers as well as health workers and trying to bring the link between health and agriculture as well as also social welfare. The extension and advisory services, I will not say much, but these are actual interventions that promote things like irrigation, small-scale irrigation, good farming practices, and these have also been provided through various forms, NGOs, but links with ministries of agriculture. And then another way that we have seen that can actually be used to institutionalize some of these responses is where we have seen countries developing HIV and AIDS strategies for the agriculture sector, where some of these responses are actually incorporated and actually become institutionalized as people carry out these interventions. So I've just put a few pictures which are there where you find people at a livestock fair, the old granny with the sweet fleshed potato that I talked about, and then as well as somebody working in their garden there. What have been the strengths of these interventions within the context of HIV and AIDS? Because some of you might ask, what's the difference between a normal, just normal gardening program? But we've gone to put this a bit under the microscope and seen that most of these interventions that I've just discussed provide immediate support for these HIV-affected households. They also improve household nutrition through the dietary diversity that I referred to. They also improve behavior and eating patterns, because this is one of the most difficult things to change, especially for grown-up people, in terms of what they should now start to eat. And then also in terms of asset promotion and generating income, because with some of these interventions, people are able to sell off the surplus. They also provide strategies that are less labor intensive and increase the knowledge and skills for OVC and the youth. And we would like to think that in terms of the food pillars, they are providing availability, access, and utilization. I would like to just borrow from one of the programs that we've been working on in Southern Africa, which is the Orphans and Vulnerable Alliance, which looks at promoting interventions geared at strategies that alleviate the impacts of HIV and AIDS on OVCs. And I think this is also part of what Stephen Devereaux has tried to look at in terms of, if we are looking at the effectiveness and appropriateness of interventions, they should really be able to protect, prevent, promote livelihoods of targeted households, and they should be accessible, predictable, affordable, guaranteed, and unconditional. We can relook at some of those interventions and see how they meet some of these criteria that I have just presented. And how are they meeting some of these criteria? By at least targeting the food insecure and nutritionally at risk, it is quite important that when we look at targeting, we are not looking at the HIV affected, especially in food, for food insecurity and livelihood insecurity, but to target those that are food insecure and nutritionally at risk. And I'm sure in the high endemic countries, we are targeting the people that we would like to target in the end. And then to integrate these interventions, because some of these interventions we're talking of in Southern Africa, drought prone. So if we are going to provide gardens, for instance, without really providing the nutrition, the water and sanitation support, then we've not done justice. And then if they are supported by institutional frameworks, as I've discussed with the HIV-AIDS strategies that are in some of the countries like Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Tanzania, and then the fact that they should be gender sensitive, if we look at the caring practices of women and how maybe some of these livelihood strategies that we're talking about are actually increasing the burden of women. And then also to build on community responses. This was really, really critical when we looked at the last study that was done by Scott Dreamy and Staviso Gandure in Zimbabwe, where we actually found out that community perceptions were really important in terms of what they themselves considered to be important interventions for them. Okay, just to dwell a bit on the challenges. In the countries that I have taken examples from, we'll see that food and nutrition insecurity is highly political, and therefore the decisions on the kinds of interventions may be quite political. Some of the targeting criteria increases stigma. That's why maybe we also try to move away from HIV affected, but to the nutritionally at risk and food insecure. And then there are always lack there is always a lack of clear exit strategies. As I have said before, we've been in an emergency from 2002 in terms of food insecurity, and most of the programs have really been emergency programs. So there has not been really a clear distinction in terms of the exit strategies. And then what came out from some of the studies were that just the quantities were just too small and they did not make any impact. If it is a livestock program, if it is a guardian program, the quantities were almost negligible. Food aid and agricultural inputs have really dominated the responses without providing the extension support that should go along with it. And then cash transfers only work in stable communities. It's unfortunate I come from Zimbabwe, but this would not be the time to give cash transfers in Zimbabwe at this moment in time. Designing implementation methods that will translate into a reduction in hunger in Southern Africa is still really a big challenge. And, of course, the issue of water, I've discussed it. Lessons learned. Well, to understand the livelihoods of people and their needs is really key. I think that cannot be underscored more. Interventions have to be based on specific contextual environments according to assets and opportunities and aspirations of target. We found that in one of the studies that was undertaken, definitely there were very big differences in terms of what kind of interventions to give to communities because of the geographical context, because of the livelihoods that these people have always had. The quality of implementation is important for success. That cannot be underscored. Short emergency have little or no impact. And then to really stress this partnership between agriculture, health, and social welfare, which we've been trying on this nutrition care and support program, which we have done in 7 countries in Southern Africa, and which is a partnership between WHO, FAO, WFP, and the local partners and local government ministries. Strong policy frameworks are required to support these interventions, and then the cost-effective challenges, solutions are still a challenge. And then the issue of inheritance, I hope somebody will touch more about it, is still an issue regarding these productive assets, which we hope people use to carry out their livelihoods. So this is my last slide on the recommendations. To support and build on existing livelihood strategies, to target attitudes and knowledges regarding food and nutrition security options, for better targeting, to target food and insecure and nutritionally at risk, and linking emergency relief with development, and then also creating the right policies in agriculture to help farmers to grow a diversity of food and to grow more food. I think SADC and COMESA are trying very hard to see how this can be possible, how instead of providing food aid coming from outside, we can actually ask the farmers to actually grow this food and then buy off that food from them. And then also to document and apply lessons learned. I know with PCI, Project Concern International, they've been trying to build up the observatories from the Zambia conference that we had about 2 years ago in terms of what is really working. Renewal, RHVP, this is in regards to Southern Africa. They've also been trying to document those lessons learned and sharing those. And then the rolling out of the joint FAO-WHO training, this one that is on nutrition care and support, which really brings out issues from production right up to consumption and the nutrition part. And then life skills, catching them young, these projects need to be expanded. So I would like to thank you, but I would like to say we do have those studies that I've been referring to, so should anyone have an interest, I've just put my email for you to take on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Farzai. That was quite an omnibus review of the various interventions, household gardens, livestock, collective labor action. It makes you wonder sometimes why we are unable to bring these things to scale in countries in a way that would alleviate the desperate hunger that's so often felt. I've never fully understood the impasses myself. I was concerned only with your reference of the expansion of sweet potatoes in Mozambique, because I fear that it will catch the attention of the Minister of Health in South Africa and shall migrate and destroy the policies in yet another country. We're now in for a treat, a shift in emphasis to the livelihood and clinical support in mobile and transient fishing communities. I say a treat because I had the privilege of looking through Janet Seeley's slides in advance, and I was quite struck and fascinated by the content. I suspect you will be too. Janet Seeley is a lecturer at the School of Development Studies, University of East Anglia. She's worked on HIV and AIDS and livelihoods issues since the late 1980s. She, with Eddie Allison, the World Fish Center, have been involved in research and advocacy on HIV/AIDS and fisher folk since 2003. It's worth it to come to a conference to hear the word fisher folk used. Janet.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. As Stephen has said, I'm not sure I can live up to the build-up, but it's a shift now to think about a group that I believe are significantly neglected, and it's one of the tragedies that UNAIDS are still not mentioning the epidemic among fisherfolk throughout the world in the global AIDS reports that we get, and we're trying very hard to change that. This is a rather out-of-date slide, but it gives you some idea of the scale of the epidemic amongst some selected fishing communities in four countries. Very quickly, the red line are the fisher folk down the bottom. You can see the number of people likely to be infected in those groups compared with other traditionally high-risk groups, truck drivers, the military, prisoners, and injecting drug users. So in a sample of 10 countries that we looked at, there are prevalence rates of between 4 to 14 times higher than the national average in 9 out of 10 of those countries among fisher folk. And we use that term because it embraces everybody involved in fishing, not just fishermen, but also fish traders, fish processors, etc., men as well as women. This is a rather stereotypical view of fishing lifestyles, but if you look throughout the world, a number of these elements that Hemrich and Tapusis mention hold true. Vulnerability because of high mobility, long absences from home, cash incomes that are erratic, but you get cash in your pocket, you want to spend it, casual sex availability, alcohol, etc. And it's not just fishermen. This quote is about fishermen, but you get women fish traders who, in order to secure their particular livelihood, may have to engage in either taking very low prices, therefore increasing their financial vulnerability, or in some places, so-called sex for fish deals, whereby they exchange fish in exchange for fish in order to secure the sale. Transactional sex is something that's quite widespread in a number of different places, not just in fishing. Poverty, vulnerability, marginalization. As I said, the fisher folk not always the poorest of the poor, so the money in the pocket is erratic. It comes, you want to spend it, and it's unlikely to be saved. There's political, social marginalization, poor access to services, and vulnerability due to insecure rights, uncertain production systems, and high physical, economic, and regulatory institutional risks. We've heard many fishing people say, you know, if we're going to die on the lake or we're going to die in a fishing accident at sea, why worry about HIV? This is a stylized schema of the potential impact of HIV on and AIDS on the fisheries sector from the individual, where you've got declining ability to work, stigmatization, out to the whole sector, where you've got issues around reduced management capacity. And it's a sad fact that we've heard some people say, well, if there are less fisher folk, then that's good for the fish. You know, they won't be so overfished. Well, that's not only a rather sad thing to say, but it's also inaccurate, because people who are hard-pressed often engage in illegal or inefficient methods which are at greater risk to the fish. So there are a number of different impacts at different levels. So what are we doing about it? Well, actually, not very much. But I've got some few examples of some of the things that are happening around the world. AMREF have a project in Homa Bay in Kenya. They're working with 200 orphans and 240 widows in that area, mainly the related to fishing. And they're working to protect their rights and look at different ways to offset the economic impact of HIV and AIDS. Papua New Guinea, the Coastal Fisheries Management and Development Project. Now, PNG and other areas in that region, you get a lot of women who are fishing, and women who are fishing and coming into contact with large trawlers and so forth, which are populated by men. They may have relationships with those men in order to secure their own catches. And some of the literature that this particular project are using highlights those relationships which are putting women as well as men at risk. And then in the Mobile Populations Project in the Greater Mekong sub-region, it's not just about fisher folk, but targeting them in issues around preventing HIV and AIDS. Again, awareness raising. Now, the Sustainable Fisheries and Livelihoods Programme in West Africa was an initiative between FAO and DFID in 25 countries. It ended last year. This was, again, around a number of different things to do about livelihoods, but included a lot of work on HIV. Awareness raising again, actually trying to create awareness through diagnosing the extent of the epidemic or the extent of knowledge of the epidemic, and then theatre for development, raising awareness through plays and so forth, as you see in many other scenarios. And then also working to establish cross-sectoral linkages and mechanisms for implementing community action plans for alternative livelihoods, trying to help people who can no longer make a living out of fishing. Addressing the social conditions of fisher folk, I found one project which I think it really sort of hits the mark on this. It's the Population Equity, AIDS and Coastal Environment Project, so-called PEACE, in Tanzania, funded by USAID. And this is really has a twofold part. One is trying to help coastal communities in their livelihoods, but also trying to address issues around resource degradation of the coastal resources and introducing alternative livelihoods again, paprika farming and milkfish aquaculture. That's a particular type of fish which evidently is quite popular there. Then another project that's just started, it's implemented by FAO and the World Fish Centre, and it's funded by the Swedish CEDA, Fisheries and HIV/AIDS in Africa. And each of these dots represents a group of local researchers or implementers doing small-scale projects under this umbrella. And they're looking at some particular areas. It's just started. It started last year. Looking at mobility and migration, trying to identify target groups of mobile populations. Looking at fish market chain. Now, this is also involved in what I mentioned before, the sex for fish deals, but also looking at the vulnerability of female fish traders who are getting, you know, scraping a living from the work they're doing, looking at business innovations for them. Then nutrition impact. Martin's mentioned this already. I think you know, we shouldn't have the idea that fisher folk are very well fed because they have a good diet of fish. The tragedy is many can't afford to eat the fish that they catch. And so, you know, looking at what could be done to the nutritional contribution of fish in target areas, the health impact of fish consumption, trying to raise awareness over the value of fish in the local areas and looking for ways to ensure that some of the fish is affordable. And then institutional change, integrating fisheries into food security monitoring, for example, there you'll see, and raising awareness amongst other related sectors. Final project I want to mention is one that's just started that I'm involved in, which is funded by the EDCTP program. It's implemented by a group of partners in Uganda and Malawi, led by the Uganda Virus Research Institute. Now, the title is rather scary, but and it's talking about preparing communities, fishing communities, for future HIV vaccine trials. Well, actually, what we're trying to do is work with fishing communities on any interventions on prevention as well as treatment and care. Because in building up so-called cohorts for vaccine trials, one has a duty of care and ethical obligations towards supporting those communities for better access to what is available now. So the two initiatives, one in Malawi and one in Uganda, have slightly different titles, but they have the same fundamental aim, trying to prove that one can work with mobile populations and these particular mobile populations for the long term, because so many of the interventions have been very short-term, one-off projects. What can we do to really, as Stephen said, to scale up? So, many of the efforts are small-scale, they're often short-term, and few as yet really address the social conditions of fisher folk, which affect the susceptibility to HIV infection and mitigate against the provision of adequate care and support services. The fishing industry throughout the world supports hundreds of thousands of livelihoods and is a source of food and employment for many, many people. Yet the spread of HIV among fisher folk remains a major threat to their survival and existence because very few of them are as yet being reached by treatment and care. So much more needs to be done to ensure that this woman fish trader in Uganda, who I've pictured here, as well as other women, men, and children, and there are many children who are fisher folk too, can enjoy, and I use enjoy advisedly, because we want them to have productive and dignified lives. Thank you.
You will agree, I think, that this is a remarkably disciplined and interesting panel. One of the pieces of material I saw said that there were 250 million fisheries-dependent people, and the extent of the fisher folk and their vulnerability, I was most interested in Papua New Guinea, because it begins to explain why Papua New Guinea has such a high prevalence rate in the South Pacific compared to some of the other countries. I thought, too, if I may be so bold, Janet, that was a stunning graph on the comparative prevalence rates amongst high-risk groups. I mean, who would have thought that the prevalence rates amongst the fisher folk of Indonesia significantly exceeded injecting drug users? I mean, that simply has never entered the sort of HIV-AIDS parlance. And therefore, I think you're quite right to say that it should have a place in the reports that are issued, because it's of great significance. We turn now to our final speaker, who is Michelle Adatto, who is going to speak to us on social protection, challenges, and responses. Michelle, I was at a conference over the last 2 days held in conjunction with the International AIDS Conference on children and AIDS, and it was quite interesting how the focus flowed to cash transfers and Social Security as the answer to the difficulties which children were facing. So your presentation is certainly germane. Michelle is a senior research fellow with IFPRI, who leads IFPRI's global program on large-scale human capital interventions,
and she's involved with Renewal's theme on AIDS, communities, resilience, community resilience, and social protection. Michelle.
I'm going to start out talking about why social protection is so important and urgent at this time. We've heard this morning the many ways in which HIV and AIDS destabilizes people's livelihoods. But what it also does is it simultaneously destabilizes those community and family safety nets that in the past have supported people in times of shock. Now, we know that those community and family safety nets are still there. They're still playing a very important role in many ways, but they don't have the sort of economic and other resources that they had when they're affected, when many people in families and communities are affected at the same time by AIDS. And what social protection does is it provides various forms of social assistance, social insurance, and social services to those who are very poor, vulnerable and excluded from society in a range of ways that don't otherwise have access to that sort of assistance. Without social protection, what we'll see is an acceleration of that vicious circle between poverty, food security, and AIDS that Sunita laid out in the initial presentation. But we'll also see a loss of human capital, of children, losses of human capital in future generations, which have irreversible consequences. There are now at least over 100 studies that show the interactions between early child nutrition, health, and education. And we know that poor and malnourished children will start school late or not start school at all. They show lower school achievement. And there is many studies showing how childhood nutrition and years of schooling affect people's wages later in life. And so we see how failure to stem the loss of human capital will have effects that are going to be passing poverty on through generations. This is a conceptual framework for showing what social protection is and what it can achieve. What we have at the bottom is a range of interventions that normally fall within the rubric of social protection. And up above, we show the various different effects that it can have, from securing basic consumption to reducing fluctuations and averting people selling off of assets, as well as enabling investment in assets and increasing their productivity, as well as transforming a range of relationships. And the point of this graph is one, that all of those different interventions can be designed in different ways to achieve all of those different objectives. However, they're going to have tendencies be more effective at achieving certain objectives than others. Certain ones that are on the left side have shown to require lower capacities on the part of beneficiaries as well as on the part of the implementing institutions. They're faster to scale up and they require lower inputs, where as you move to the right-hand side, it requires higher capacities and higher inputs and are going to be slower to scale. So there's good arguments for all these different interventions, but there's going to be trade-offs between them. I'm going to focus first on some impacts of cash transfers and food transfers because those have some of the best impact evaluations, and then I'm going to present a range of other social protection options that can be designed in ways to make them AIDS appropriate or appropriate to populations that are highly affected by AIDS. The purpose of this slide here is just to show that cash transfers and large-scale social protection more generally is not just a pipe dream on the part of idealists, that actually these large-scale programs exist and other ones are in planning stages with governments having serious plans to scale them up. Now, those questions as to whether, sort of to what extent that scale-up will take place, but currently we've got programs in South Africa that have reached over 8 million people, Ethiopia as well, which is not on here because it's a slightly different design, but that reaches over 8 million people with it's a cash transfer and food transfer for work activities. We've got tens of thousands of people covered by old age pensions in Southern Africa, and now in some of the countries that are normally associated as poor, where we'd expect social protection to be more difficult to scale up, Kenya, Zambia, Malawi, and Uganda are all, they've got pilots, and they're in the process of scaling up to tens of thousands, and they've got plans to go up to the hundreds of thousands now. Kenya and Malawi appear to be largely on track. Zambia and Uganda have run into some problems, and so there's questions around political will, political commitment, and capacities that I can come back to if there's time, but nevertheless, this shows what is possible. We did a review in conjunction with Renewal and the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and AIDS, looking at impacts on human capital from cash transfer programs in particular. And I'm just going to show a small sample of impacts on school enrollment. South Africa national data showed a 25% increase on enrollment. Ethiopia has shown an increase for boys, but no impact on girls. And I want to say something about gender impacts in a minute. Zambia and South Africa have both showed the highest impacts on the 5 to 6 year olds, showing an increasing school readiness, possibly as a result of increased nutrition. But you see a very sharp drop here in Zambia once you get beyond those first couple of years, and you see still a good impact on boys, but very little actually negative there on girls. And I think the point of this is to say that while cash transfers have showed effectiveness, there are still big gender gaps, and it's important to pay attention to gender in design. Health impacts, we've shown the new results from the scaling up cash transfer program in Malawi has showed in terms of reported health improvements, an increase of 55% people saying reporting health improvements. The study in Zambia showed a reduction of 12 percentage points in incidence of illness. In South Africa, a study showed that the child support grant, if received in the first year of life and for two-thirds of that period, will increase child height. South Africa, the old age pension was also showed to have a significant increase on child height, but there's also some gender effects there as well. I think what's interesting about this particular slide, which looks at 7 different cash transfer programs in sub-Saharan Africa, what it does is it shows that people spend the cash transfer on food, so concerns about maybe people making bad spending choices and so on are largely unfounded. Between 40 and 70% of the cash transfer is normally spent on food. The other category is other, and some of the items that go under other are transportation, and that's important when you think about the people's need for transportation to look for work, to reach the clinics, to pick up their ARVs. Also, clothing and blankets. So cash provides for people's other additional household needs. Okay, I'm going to report some selective impacts on food transfer and nutrition programs. The first two results are from generalized ones that are not with AIDS-affected populations in particular, but 16 out of 18 evaluations showed that maternal and child health and nutrition programs were reducing stunting. Early results from comparing different types of food supplementation for highly malnourished children in Kenya found 80 to 90% recovery rates. I'm going to skip now because I don't want to take up too much time, but basically on some of the ones that worked with HIV-affected populations in particular found in Tanzania that women who received a daily a multivitamin supplementation were significantly less likely to progress to the higher stages in terms of the WHO disease progression or die of AIDS-related causes. And some new research by McNamara and Sunita and others in Uganda have shown that ART plus food and food alone had positive impacts on weight gain and slowed health status decline. Okay, I'm going to present some other types of social protection, approaches to social protection that don't have the same kind of impact evaluations that have been done, but nevertheless show promise in terms of reaching AIDS-affected people, populations, especially when they are designed in a particular way, not in a conventional way, to be appropriate to a particular set of circumstances. In South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal in particular, household contracts have been designed for families that have flexible hours that allow families to substitute labor. Different family members can all participate, and that showed a reduction in families that reported having to reduce children's meals from 34% down to 1%, and a substantial increase in school attendance rates. In Zimbabwe, public works programs have designed very light work activities as well as more restricted tasks to families that are weaker, as well as providing childcare. Very interesting innovations going on in the area of home-based care and early childhood development in a number of countries in southern Africa. In Zimbabwe and Mozambique, they're doing work with home-based care. Zimbabwe has monitoring and referral and particular work around ART in particular. South Africa has some very interesting work going on in its Department of Education and Department of Health and Department of Public Works to scale up to hundreds of thousands of learners in the area
of home-based care and ECD, and to provide work opportunities. So those aren't necessarily work opportunities for people who are directly affected or severely affected by AIDS, but it provides the care services, and it shows how public works can be made to be relevant in an AIDS-affected context. The other public works are also joining up with information, education, and communication activities that center around AIDS education and a number of other health and nutrition education issues. There's limits on those in terms of how, when you get into these very complicated designs, how many people you can reach, as opposed to the large-scale cash transfers that can reach more people more quickly. And also, when you're talking about ECD and home-based care, there's some serious questions raised about the quality of the services. You can't scale it very quickly and not worry about making sure that those services, caring for children and ill people, are not very well done and implemented. Now, on microcredit and livelihoods, FADSAI gave, I think, a very comprehensive review of livelihoods, and so I'm not including this in my presentation, but I want to say a few things about microcredit because it generally tends to not be the best approach for families that are suffering some of the more severe consequences of HIV and AIDS. Nevertheless, there are ways in which microcredit has been designed to be responsive, mixing, having groups that include both affected and non-affected households, using them to promote education and preventive services, having rest terms between loans, offering financial packages that require everybody to purchase certain kinds of health and burial and life insurance, also targeting it to those members who are HIV positive but still productive. And a study in Zimbabwe of a program that implemented some of those particular aspects of design showed that clients actually had higher savings and school enrollment compared to the non-affected clients. Other approaches involve linking transfers, food or cash transfers, with the different types of education activities. In Kenya, the new cash transfer program there links with lectures on maternal and child health and prevention and treatment of illness and nutrition, using paydays to promote information and behavioral messages and giving people information about health services as well as information on psychosocial support and the possibility as well of income generation programs. Now, there's going to be hard-to-reach children, which require a whole different type of set of interventions in terms of street children, abandoned, institutionalized, as well as child-headed households, and so there's some smaller-scale work doing on creative approaches to trying to reach those others who would not necessarily be captured by a cash transfer program in particular. I want to talk about what I think are some of the key policy debates within social protection currently. One is around food or cash transfers. There are now a lot of work has been done on food or cash outside of an HIV-affected context and found that there are relative advantages and disadvantages that have to do with markets and prices, capacities, politics, and gender relations. For very severely malnourished and ART patients, people need food now. So food transfers and nutrition programs might be more appropriate. On the other hand, cash also assists with both food as well as transportation and other household needs. And I don't think this is an either-or, and we can come back to this, but these are our issues that are currently being debated. And certainly all of these issues take on whole new dimensions in the context of rising food prices. Other important questions around targeting, who should be targeted and how. Now, there was a lot of momentum for many years building up around orphans. A consensus at this point seems to be being reached around not targeting on AIDS in particular and on orphans, but rather on multiple poverty and vulnerability criteria, for example, labor constraint or high dependency ratios. However, some of the papers that were presented the last couple of days at the conference, the symposium on children and AIDS, were also pointing to the fact that we still need to be attentive to the situation of orphans. In Malawi and Zambia, a program that targeted specifically on multiple vulnerability criteria were found that 70% of the participants were actually directly AIDS affected. We might want to make an exception for ART patients in terms of doing AIDS-specific targeting there. There's a big question now around the question of child support grant or pensions. in six African, Southern African, Eastern African countries, over 50% of orphans are living with the elderly. And so reaching AIDS-affected children through old age pensions have been shown to be effective. On the other hand, there's going to be some children that are going to be missed. And so that's a debate happening in a number of countries right now. Also, when you use conventional means tests or community-based methods, and there's some questions, community-based methods have been shown to be effective in a number of the new programs in Africa, but there are some problems and complications in trying to scale them up. There will be debates around direct transfers versus livelihood support. I think maybe we can come back to that, but there's certainly a case for some people that need direct transfers now versus some of the kinds of livelihood support options that FADS have presented. But it's not an either-or. There's ways to combine these. Another debate going on around combining transfers with services. One is a debate about conditionality. Do you require people to participate in health and nutrition and education services as they do in Latin America and parts of Asia, which have shown to have very high impacts through very good impact assessments? On the other hand, there's some very good questions being raised about whether or not in the African context the supply of services is adequately available to be able to make conditioning appropriate currently. But there are a number of ways of combining social transfers with services without making them mandatory. And social welfare services, a big debate going on about that right now, child protection, so psychosocial support, very good arguments for why you need these types of services, not just a cash or a food transfer. On the other hand, the transfer programs are difficult to implement, and are you going to overburden them if you try to load all of these different dimensions onto a cash transfer program? Questions around duration of coverage, how long do people stay in the program, how do you bring them out of the program? There are life cycle approaches, if you've got the resources to cover people at all these crucial stages of the life cycle. On the other hand, for many countries that are just starting out with social protection programs, you might need to start small and then scale up as is possible. And then some questions around capacity and affordability, or I should say costs, because I think affordability is really a political economic question, but costs, there's costing that needs to be done. I'm just going to make some final comments here on what I perceive are the knowledge, the gaps in knowledge and in action. We need to compare impacts not only within a particular kind of program, but costs across different program types, and really costs and benefits across program types. We know certain kinds of programs are very effective, but effective as compared to what? The dilemma is that action is needed now. If you don't provide that social protection to children between 0 and 2, they're never going to recover from the effects that they're currently experiencing. And so how do you balance that need for cost analysis, for comparing across programs, to the need to say this is a good strategy, we need to scale this up now? We need typologies of different kinds of programs across different regions, different contexts within those regions, and for different groups. What kinds of programs are most relevant to particular areas and particular people within those areas? There are very strong gender effects of all these different programs. Who gets the benefit? Who benefits in terms of the outcomes? And those need more attention to program design. And there's some interesting attention to that in Latin America. I think that as these programs now move into sub-Saharan Africa, there needs to be more attention to gender. Capacity audits. What exists currently that could be scaled up to providing services, to providing transfers, and implementing these different types of interventions? And what sort of modalities exist for technical support? There's been some experience with mobile task teams. Do we need something like that for social protection? And then finally, the last point I want to make is about political commitment. Because I think there is sufficient evidence now that social protection programs are feasible and they are affordable. But the largest gap seems to be in terms of political commitment. There's been a huge amount of progress. I was at the African Union regional meeting in social protection for Eastern and Southern Africa in May, and 17 countries presented very ambitious plans for social protection. I think there's a lot of commitment now in this area, but what you find is in the implementation phase, a lot of roadblocks, stumbling points. And so thinking back to that slide I presented on going from a few thousand pilots up to hundreds of thousands, are we going to get there? And what is needed in terms of work on the part of champions in government as well as the international community and actors in civil society to try to achieve those goals?
I would think that it's pretty exciting to be on the cutting edge of the cash transfer debate. One of the things, another expert whom I'm sure Michelle has worked closely with and knows well, Dr. Linda Richter, was saying that one of the fascinating things about the cash transfers is how inexpensive they are, that they can consume something like 0.5% up to 1.5% of GNP, which is very, very small percentage of a country's wealth if, in fact, the social transfer is rolled out across the country to, say, 10 or 20% of the poorest families. It would make an astonishing difference in the fight against the pandemic. That ends, I think, the formal interventions. Because we started late and because there are people in the audience who might well wish to ask questions, if the panel doesn't mind, I'm going to turn it over to the audience because we only have about 20 minutes remaining. There are two microphones in the center of the room. I judge that they are controlled by the Eminence Grise in this corner. If anyone wants to ask a question, please do. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm not shy. Is this on?
Okay, yes, if you would introduce yourself and your organization if you're affiliated.
Sure. My name is Kate Greenway. I'm currently unaffiliated. I'm a consultant. I work with a number of NGOs. And I wanted to congratulate the panel on a really focused, really punchy presentation. It was fabulous. I need to make a quick pitch, and then I have a quick comment. I hope you could bear with me to take two spaces. But I'm working with PCI, with Project Concern International, on the forum, the Africa Forum 2009, which is the follow-on from the forum that Fadzai mentioned, Africa Forum 2006. It's specifically on food security, nutrition, and HIV. It's four practitioners on the ground. It's not a big, big, posh conference. It's very much a for-the-ground, who's right in the field. It's their conference. That's your conference if that's who you are. There are save the date and get in touch with us cards on the back table, or you can grab one from me. I'll stay around until the bitter end and catch you as you leave. A comment that I wanted to make, really, just it strikes me that I'm seeing more and more that there's urban hunger, and we used to think that hunger was sort of something we found more in rural areas, and we needed to work on food security and growing crops and that kind of approach. And I know that the cash transfer piece is really going to help with urban hunger in sort of emergent or urgent phases. But I'm just asking us all to pay attention to livelihoods in its purest form for urban communities who are experiencing such extreme hunger and poverty related to HIV impacts. And that, I'm just throwing it out there as a thought because I'm not sure anybody would want to respond, but please can we keep it on our radar? Thanks.
Thank you, Kate. Thoughts are always welcome. If you are going to ask a specific question, could you direct it to the panelist of choice? Yes, go ahead. Next.
Hi, my name is Caroline Eintjes, and I'm from the Netherlands. I work for ETC Crystal as a consultant. I just came back from Indonesia on an assignment, and what struck me from Mrs. Seeley's presentation was the statistics on the fisher folk. Because I talked to a number of key players, the National AIDS Commission, UNAIDS, FHI, Australian Aid, nobody mentioned this. I came across one NGO working in the southern part of Papua, who were targeting the fisher folk. I would just like to get some more background on the data itself and, how was it discovered? Why is it not being paid attention to? What's the opinion of Mrs. Seeley? Thanks.
Please, Janet, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Margaret Wagner.
Could you wait one moment, Margaret? I'd like Janet to respond, if I may. Thank you.
Yes, I mean, that was why what provoked us to look into this more closely. The graph came from a paper published in AIDS in 2005 where we reviewed all the available literature that we could find on HIV in fisher folk, and the statistics comes from drawing that together from across the world. And I think it is, perhaps some people have said and told us that fisher folk are not a focus because it's a fuzzy area. There are fish farmers, there are some people who do it as a very minor part of their livelihood. Where do you draw the line? It's not a livelihood that's so easily defined. But I think the striking thing from an increasing body of literature, because there are a large number of researchers engaged in looking at this more closely, is that the prevalence levels are high in different places in the world. There's some recent data from Uganda, from Lake Victoria, the lakeshore communities, where you've got prevalence rates of 20 to 27%, and you go inland and it's 6, 7%, which is still high, but it's horrendous in some of these coastal communities. And I think it is an emergency that we've really been quite blind to.
Thank you for that. Martin wants to say a word to Kate about urban hunger.
Yeah, well, one of the impacts of high food prices will be particularly on the urban areas. I mean, we have seen that, for example, in Indonesia. And it has shifted the fact that high food prices, the whole discussion among the UN agencies as well as the NGOs, that we have to focus a lot on quality food and what kind of form, and particularly in urban areas. When you think about sustainable issues, you cannot ignore, for example, the private sector. And that's why groups like GAIN, for example, are very much involved in both looking into sustainable approaches so that you can actually do a good cash transfer program, because if there's no product available so that actually they can buy a good product which is, you know, highly nutritious, it doesn't help very much, as particularly when you focus on young children or when you focus on people living with HIV, for example, who are, the demands are much higher, or tuberculosis. So I think this whole, what we see in WFP is that the last couple of months we have an enormous trend into looking very carefully how we can actually improve the food basket with much more high quality products. But as an agency, you can do that, you can't do that alone. And that's why I think the nutritional community as specifically is very serious about looking in all different ways to improve the quality, and focusing particularly also on the urban areas.
Go ahead, Michelle.
Again, a quick response to Kate. Is this on? Yeah, just to say that this is not specific to the urban context, but I think your question around not forgetting about livelihoods, your point is a broader one, and there's different ways to look at it. One is that a straight cash transfer for the very labor constrained, for those that have such high dependency ratios that they could work, but they really sort of practically can't. However, cash, I mean, again, it isn't an either or, working together can be very effective. Cash can be used for investments. Research in Mexico on the cash transfer progress has shown productive improvements and investments from using the cash transfer there. Recent results from a study by IFPRI in Ethiopia showed, of their productive safety nets program, showed that a cash transfer plus agricultural technology support and agricultural services was more effective than a straight cash transfer in terms of certain food security indicators and investment indicators. However, in both of those studies, you've got a more productive population. People are not necessarily, on the whole, as affected. And so, it depends on who you're trying to reach and what kind of program you would want.
Margaret, thank you for being so patient. The microphone is yours.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My first question goes to Martin on the issue of high food prices. The reason why I'm asking this is because in hyper-endemic communities, we are now faced with a situation where the high food price is complicating and, if anything, might even undermine some of the gains that are beginning to be felt. And the impact on HIV and AIDS, particularly amongst the poor, who already have problems with accessing food, who already are having those kinds of problems, is going to be very, very devastating. So I don't know what you have or you can tell us, according to WFP's policy, on policy responses that you see can be put in place to cushion those that are in critical need and are being impacted negatively by high food price. So that's my first question. The second question goes to Michelle and Fazai. And again, my observation here is that you have told us, you did tell us about targeting the food insecure and nutritionally at risk. I'm working on a project with WFP, and we were trying to develop a guideline on targeting people living with HIV/AIDS who are food insecure and nutritionally at risk. And our experiences is that targeting these populations is very complex, because the assumption is not all households or communities who are HIV/AIDS are food insecure, and not all food insecure households are HIV/AIDS positive. So when you want to target for food assistance, how do you do it in order not to have in as your beneficiaries those that are, in order that you do not end up with populations that you don't need, to eliminate the inclusion and exclusion errors? How do you target effectively? And the same will come to cash transfers. How do you target that you only end up with actual populations that are at risk? Thank you.
Thank you. Those are very reasonable questions, well designed. Martin, do you want to take the first?
Yeah, absolutely. Very important question, very difficult to answer, in the sense that WFP, in, of course, in close collaboration with UNICEF, for example, have designed various safety net programs. And in fact, what we are trying to do at the headquarters level, especially under the leadership of our new executive director, is being more innovative, looking at what I said before. The issue of quality food is extremely important now for WFP. However, to implement that is, of course, much more complicated, because we actually don't even have, some of the products are not even available. You know, there's a lot of research ongoing. Furthermore, there is, of course, an enormous lack of funding, even despite the fact that we got $1 billion more to actually do, you know, action at the ground. If you look at the problems which are currently going on in Ethiopia and in Somalia, as well as Sudan, you know, a lot of the costs would already go to those costs, to those countries. So what I would say is that on a theoretical basis, we're trying to work as much as possible with a lot of other partners to come up with good safety nets, which has a sustainable aspect, but include, in fact, very much the shift at the same time, that we can't just give food for food anymore, but that we have to give high-quality food as part of the food basket, particularly for vulnerable groups. As well as the mechanism, how we going to do it, is again not only food alone, but we are very much into new mechanisms, like, for example, the cash transfer, conditional cash transfer, all the different possibilities. But again, of course, the country offices are also changing, and they are under pressure at the same time. So this is a major obstacle. I mean, so we have a lot of the country offices coming to Rome and have discussions what the new program should be. We don't know all the answers, and I think the world doesn't know all the answers. And that's why, in fact, we need to be very, very keen on doing monitoring evaluation and work, for example, with a group like IFPRI, who does a lot more research on, you know, what works and what doesn't work. But at the same time, we have to act now. And I think this is what's going on. And I think we need a lot more funding, in fact, to support, whether it's in the form of food or whether it's in the form of, you know, whatever that cash transfers. But I personally think it's a problem which is still underestimated. I think the impacts will be much bigger than people now at this particular moment really realize.
I thank you for saying that, Martin, because I'm persuaded as well that that's true. Farzai, do you want to take the first crack at the second question that was asked?
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I think I would still insist on the targeting of food insecure and nutritionally at risk, but still go back to the point in terms of what kind of intervention are we talking about. Because with some of the interventions, be it food aid, maybe, in most instances, you do hit the target right in terms of maybe these are people that are accessing antiretroviral treatment, yeah? But for the food insecure and nutritionally insecure, especially in high endemic countries, in most instances, you'll be able to hit the right target that you'd like to target. Thanks.
Michelle?
Yeah. Margaret, I would, for you to some of the work that was done in Zambia and Malawi on the around targeting on the cash transfer programs there. I can show you, I can give you some of those reports, because they did a very interesting process of workshopping this and working with a number of communities on how to develop a system for targeting the cash transfer. And
sorry, we've got a problem with the audio.
And what they came to, they use community-based processes that involve local area committees and district committees, and they came up with, across a number of communities, a set of criteria that, as I had mentioned before, it has to do with labor constrained, of dependency ratios of about 3 to 1, and what was considered extreme poverty that was often locally defined, although there was a fair amount of commonality across the definitions. And what happens is a community committee comes together and decides who that group, a pool of people that meet those criteria. And then there's a district-level committee from there that reviews it so that there are some checks and balances to the system. Now, there are going to be people that are missed through that, and that's one of the things that some of the people working on the cash transfer programs are looking into. But largely it's worked well, and as I mentioned, some research that was done on that tried to look at who was targeted in comparison to data that was collected according to a number of criteria as AIDS affected that had to do with deaths from illnesses and orphans and certain other indicators, found that 70% of the people in that program were what they called severely AIDS affected. So the program managed to catch those people, but at the same time they were catching the people who were poor and food insecure. And so again, probably targeting based on food insecurity and extreme poverty might be a better way than AIDS, than trying to get as directly AIDS-affected population because of stigma issues in terms of equity issues, because the evidence on whether orphans are more disadvantaged than non-orphans is very mixed. But again, there are going to be some populations like on ART that you might be able to work with programs directly through the clinics, whether it's food or cash.
We have a looming problem because we have more people wanting to ask questions than the time available. But if you can ask the question fairly quickly, and I'll prevail on the panelists to reply briefly, maybe we can get through two or three of you, maybe all. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. My question goes primarily to Michelle. My name is Gavin Silva. I'm from the Treatment Action Campaign. In South Africa, you mentioned how children and OAPs have the means to supplement healthy living through, you know, the old age pension grant and the child grant respectively. But that effectively leaves out everyone between the ages of 18 and 65, who at the moment only have access through the disability grant. And to access that, you need to be so sick that you're unable to work. So my question is, how do you reward staying healthy rather than rewarding getting sick? And how do you end this cycle of, especially people with chronic illnesses, becoming so sick that they're unable to work, going onto a grant for a year, getting better, and then getting off the grant and having the whole cycle repeat itself? How do you change, or how do you suggest that policy changes around the social welfare system in South Africa to better target this massive segment of the population?
Go ahead.
Okay, I think it's a difficult question, especially because I know there's a time limitation. There are problems around the criteria for the disability grant, which is very restrictive, and then you have people falling, you know, back ill again, as you point out. I think it's a serious problem. And right now, the child support grant largely, it goes for the family as a whole, so it's not that those people between 18 and 65 are completely uncovered. The grant is distributed, but as there's arguments for making the grant higher, and certainly it's not sufficient as a poverty alleviation strategy, but it's as you know, what they've got going so far. And again, the old age pension also supports many people as well, so they're both dependent on that. But the idea of a disability grant is sort of a whole other debate, in a sense, right? So, yeah.
Maybe the two of you can have a chat immediately afterwards. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Peter, and my question goes to Martin. I'm the national coordinator for Renew in Uganda, and at the start of the increasing food prices, there was this line of argument that the increase in the prices, in food prices, is actually beneficial to the farm, from which you would get income to meet the food and nutritional requirements, apart from gaining more income. And my question is, have you come across any evidence across any of the countries or from the recent history that supports this line of argument? Thank you.
Well, I think it's a very good question because it always comes up as an argument. If you remember, the first slides I show was from rural Bangladesh. And it was clear that, in fact, the rural population in Bangladesh was actually benefiting from low rice prices. And you would say, well, it's all rural, they produce rice. But in fact, only 5% of that population were actually net producers of rice, and most were net consumers of food. And I think that's happening in many, many places in the world, except maybe in certain, you know, so you have to make the analysis first, where, in fact, people are really actually producing more than actually, so that they can sell. This is one of the reasons why I said that the high food prices, in first instance, will have an impact on urban populations who are completely dependent, of course, on a market economy. I'm not saying that at the because within WFP there are a lot of discussions about small farmers, how can they may still benefit from the high food prices. That's maybe possible, but also the inputs for the farmers are also increasing. For example, the fuel prices, I mean, fertilizers, you know, there are other issues like transport, you know, going to the market. If the farmers don't have access to big markets, that's not a problem. I'm not an economist, I'm a medical doctor, so I'm not the right person to talk to you on this topic, but I know it's much more complicated. And I personally think the reality is that a lot more people will actually have problems with the high food prices then, in fact, people will benefit from it. But it doesn't mean that of course, you know, you still, you know, for example, we do what we call P4P, that we actually support farmers to produce locally and so that actually they can actually use those products for also the vulnerable groups. So there are different ways to tackle that. But I think in general, more people will actually have a negative impact of high food prices.
Okay, in the interests of equity, let's see if we can get the last two questions in. And we'll do it as quickly as possible. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Mary Njoroge. I'm from WFP. And mine is actually just a comment to support what Martin said, and also on the programming side regarding urban programming. Kate and Margaret, they asked about urban programming, and Margaret was very specific about high food prices and the impact. Just to share with you a little bit, WFP has been doing assessments in most of the countries that have been affected, and we can talk about it more, you know, after this. I realize that we do not have time. And also we have managed to, in these assessments, we have a component of HIV, so once the analysis is done, we'll be able to capture how households affected by HIV and AIDS are coping. The second thing is that in the whole debate about high food prices, if you look at the June declaration, you find that the high-level meeting which was held in Rome, you find that social protection has been kind of the immediate response, you know, more or less like, you know, give the money to WFP. And in that, there is a focus on the immediate needs. And the focus also on vulnerable groups. And within these vulnerable groups, we have HIV and AIDS. I think that is a big, big step, you know, for us, and we just need to make sure that there is, you know, there is real impact. Lastly, just to mention that at this stage, WFP, we are not able to share with you any of these assessment reports. Martin mentioned about the qualitative study, which is ongoing now in Swaziland and in Malawi, but we are hoping that from this study we'll be able to capture, you know, key trends and issues, and we'll be able to share with you in the coming weeks. Thank you.
When will the assessment reports be available?
It's divided into countries. There are some which are complete, actually. We can have a small discussion after that. There are some which are ongoing, but I think what is important is when you look at the impact of high food prices and HIV prevalence, you know, this is, you know, where we have to kind of pick the 20 countries which are kind of relevant in our case. But I'm willing to have a small discussion after this session. Thank you.
Thank you. The last question or comment.
Yes, alcoholism FAO. The causes for the higher food prices, they are different. opinions on degrees, and by fear, bad weather and speculation, etc., etc., disagreement on the what extent different causes are impacted. But in the FAO high-level conference in June, it was discussed. Biofuel was one of the key issues, and it was discussed, but there was a disagreement among member countries between those who are producing and those who are not producing. And I would like to take this point that the Latin American countries made this point, and they disagreed the final resolution from the conference, that they are saying that the resolution failed to pinpoint the key issues, fundamental issues, which is that the current increasing food prices is the consequence of failure of capitalism. So I think that this is not a fair view, my personal view, but I think there are two key policy measures could be taken immediately. One is a moratorium on biofuel production, and the second is taking specific measures on speculation.
A moratorium on what?
Biofuel production, because land is disappearing, taking away from communities by investors. And UN should make more decisive role in this debate. So what we need is really more fundamental political and economic solutions to a current crisis. Otherwise, HIV/AIDS-affected, infected people would be the first one to be, you know, to suffer. And just to mention a comment on this, the farmers benefiting from high food prices, as far as I'm aware from different studies, The key finding is that poor farmers are net consumers, so they are equally negatively affected by increasing food prices. Thank you.
Thank you. I make only the slightly acerbic comment that if you want the UN to take a lead, there's something called the Food and Agricultural Organization that might begin to do more actively in public terms than it has thus far done. I very, very much appreciate the participation of the panelists. I must say I regret that this panel precedes the formal conference, because in terms of the presentations, they're one of the most interesting panels I've attended. And I thank you all on behalf of all of us here assembled. It's a small but passionate, attentive, and committed audience. Thanks, everyone. We're adjourned.